Well, good day and welcome to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the pod medic, and we're back with another hurricane-related episode. This one was initially planned to be a kind of recap of some of the things that happened down at Harvey with some of our team that were down there. But we have Hurricane Irma coming in as we record this later this in the weekend. That we're recording this on a Wednesday night right before Irma hits the U.S. And so we're going to be talking about that hurricane as well. So stay tuned, sit back, tighten your seatbelts. We're going to get into this thing. And of course, if we're going to do that, that means we have to get Sam, who's recently back from the Texas area, and have her come on and talk a little bit. Hey, Sam, what's up?
Oh, my God, Jamie, this could be the most compelling podcast we've ever done, because we could say we're right dead in the middle of an historical situation. And I'm sure Kyle, I can't wait to hear Kyle's assessment, because we have not only Irma, who's taking a very devastating path, but we have those two other storms out there. So let's just throw it to Kyle, because I can't wait to hear what he has to say.
Well, thanks, Sam, and hello to everyone out there on the Disaster Podcast. This, as Jamie said, hopefully this is going to be a recap episode, but we're right back into the thick of it, so let's go straight to the Atlantic. As of 8 o'clock Eastern time here on September 6th, we currently have three Atlantic hurricanes that are named. So Irma, Jose, and newly today named Katia. So let's kind of work our way back here. So Katia, expected to remain nearly stationary where it is in the Gulf of Mexico and slowly turn southwest into southern Mexico later this week. Hurricane Jose is forecasted to follow nearly the exact same path as Irma has, at least through the weekend, passing just north of Anguilla and the U.S. Virgin Islands, and then forecast to turn north at this point, which now right now looks to spare Puerto Rico a direct hit. Some impacts are still likely to be felt if Jose continues to grow and intensify, but it's definitely too soon to say for sure. And now to Irma, a monstrous Category 5 hurricane wreaking havoc in the Atlantic, and it's currently moving away from the northernmost Virgin Islands, and it's moving west northwest at about 16 miles an hour. So this is going to continue for the next couple of days. Right now on the forecast track, the core, the center of Irma, where the highest winds are located, is going to pass just north of Puerto Rico tonight and be near Turks and Caicos and the southeastern Bahamas by the evening on Thursday. Currently 185 miles an hour, sustained winds with higher gusts near the eye of the storm, but hurricane force winds extend 50 miles out from the center, tropical storm force winds 185 miles out from the center. So let's not get too hung up on where the center of this is going to go. Let's talk impacts here. The current forecast puts Irma to make a run up the east coast of Florida. And that is expected to occur with, later this week and into the weekend. Of course, the forecast track can change. This is still a very fluid situation. We're still 4 days out from, 3 to 4 days out from any effects being felt in the Florida Keys, but that doesn't mean that we should just ignore it. Evacuations are underway, and I expect that to continue in southern Florida. But the ideal scenario is that the easterly shift in the track continues and Irma recurves out to sea. Worst case scenario is that it makes a run directly up the length of the Florida Peninsula. Either way, you need to be staying tuned to the latest forecast from the National Hurricane Center, your local National Weather Service office, and your local emergency management folks. They are your local experts. They are the ones who are going to give you the timely information to keep yourself, your family, and your colleagues safe. That's all I've got for the hurricane update. Back to you guys.
A question for you, Kyle. What are the weather conditions, and I know the temperature of the water is one of them, and probably the atmosphere in general, that's spawning all these earthquakes?
You mean hurricanes, right?
Hurricanes. Yeah, what? Oh, did I say earthquakes? Oh, my God, I'm not tired. Excuse me for that. I'm still decompressing. Anyway, you know what I mean, Kyle.
Yeah, Sam, I've worked with you long enough. I know exactly what you're talking about.
I'm back in California and in my brain. I don't know.
No, that's all good. And that's a great question. So with what exactly, what spawns these hurricanes? Why do these things occur? Well, we're actually 4 days away from the average peak. So September 10 is like the average peak of the Atlantic hurricane season. And this season is delivering in full. So the conditions for any of these tropical cyclone formations, so that's including tropical depression, tropical storm, and hurricane. So we want warm ocean water. We're looking for about 80 degrees or warmer, ideally. We need a lot of moisture in the lower and middle atmosphere. We need a low wind shear environment so that the winds are not very strong and they're not changing too much with height. We need some type of pre-existing disturbance. So you'll hear the term like a wave or a tropical wave that moves, or a disturbance that moves off the coast of Africa. Well, that's what kind of initiates all this. And it has to be at least 300 miles away from the equator so it can start to rotate. You put those conditions together, like in the part of the Atlantic where Irma and Jose and all these storms have formed, and you have the recipe for a tropical cyclone.
Wow, good to know. Well, Jamie, you're lucky because you caught both Joe and I in a very unique moment of being home in between storms. So fortunately, we have Dr. Joe with us here for probably a day or two. And he's got some adventures to tell. I mean, the ones you told me, Joe, I mean, just trying to get around was pretty amazing for you.
Yeah, hi everybody. It's nice to be back in Memphis with dry feet for a change.
Really.
Have a very brief stay here. As a matter of fact, I got in last night about 8:30 or something like that, and literally on the drive home from the airport, got a call to say that the team had been activated again for Hurricane Irma. So, you know, just enough time during the day today to kind of wash clothes and catch up on the mail and say hi to the family and that sort of thing before it's time to turn around and go again.
Well, that's what you do. So tell us, you know, you made a comment to me earlier that each of the first 4 days was like day one, which is when you're trying to get your bearings and figure out where you're going. And you had different challenges on each of those days. Can you tell us about that?
Well, sure. So this deployment for Hurricane Harvey had an awful lot of very unique challenges to it. I think that one of the most challenging was, unlike some of the big hurricanes that we've seen in the past, you know, there's the initial event of the hurricane impact with wind and rain and all the stuff that goes along with that, and then the flooding that follows. But this one was different in that the rain event literally lasted for 3.5 days. And, you know, the idea of trying to work in conditions of, you know, 40 and 50 mile an hour winds and 12 inches of rainfall in, you know, 12 hours is pretty crazy and made for some really difficult challenges for us, in that we would, you know, be trying to get to a spot where we could go to work and could get into a spot and would go to work for a while and then couldn't get out of that spot because we had been flooded in and we were stuck on an island someplace. One attempt to get into an arena to, you know, be a place to house some task forces and stage equipment and that sort of stuff basically resulted in a couple of hours worth of trying to offload in a torrential downpour and then noticing that the water kept rising, and then a realization that that building, which we were assured by multiple local officials has never, ever flooded before, ended up 3 feet underwater. So we were literally moving teams to looking for higher ground at, you know, middle of the night. In a torrential rainstorm with no power and all that sort of stuff. So there were some very comical episodes of seeing our smaller vehicles like pickup trucks and SUVs and that sort of stuff literally moved on to the back of a low boy trailer so that they would be far enough out of the water that we could drive them out with the big rig or pick them up with a forklift or something like that so that we could get them moved. I even remember a news reporter that was sort of following one of the teams around, and she and her cameraman were in a small SUV. And I remember seeing this trailer drive past me with water up to the level of the low boy trailer. And several vehicles on there, including this news SUV, sitting on the very tail end of this trailer, facing backwards with those two people sitting in it as it created quite a wave trying to work its way down a street to get us out of that situation. And I just remember thinking how comical that looked to see those two people sitting in there. I'm sure quite concerned. And wondering if maybe their desire to embed with us might be a bad decision since we were now, you know, carrying them to their certain death. So we had quite a few episodes like that.
Oh, my God. They didn't know what they were getting into. Well, tell us about you were doing mostly water rescues when you could get to them. So how did that work? How many people did you interact with?
So that is correct. This one was almost exclusively water rescue and wide area search. The flooding obviously fairly unprecedented and changing quite dramatically from day to day. And I think the comment I made to you earlier is we sort of had four first days. You know, usually for us, a first day is to get in position, try to get some. Try to get out in the field as quick as we can, but at the same time, try to set up a staging area and get our communications established and, start working on logistics and some of those kind of things. And the real problem for us on this one was as soon as we would initiate that process, we'd get flooded out of that area and have to pick it all up and move and then do it all again the next day where we'd be flooded out again and have to move yet again. And then finally, by the third day, we weren't actually flooded out. We were flooded in. So we were in a dry spot, but we couldn't get out because we were flooded all around. So made it really challenging to get our teams out, get out in the water and go to work. We certainly had a tremendous amount of support and, well, that's not even the right way to say that. We were there in support of the state of Texas, which has tremendous capability and competence in managing these major disasters. And so we were working with a lot of state resources. There were obviously a lot of civilian resources that we can talk about later that did some good stuff and did some bad stuff. The problem really, like I said, was just kind of being able to get things up and rolling and get out in the field and get going.
Well, I know you ran into our friend, Dr. Ben Abo out there. What was Ben doing?
So, yes, my dear friend Ben was there with one of the task forces, and I finally managed to run across him about 4 or 5 days into this thing. He was at a location that was about 90 miles from where I was. And we were in communities like, Horton and, Angleton and, Rosario and, a lot of different places like that, as well as Houston. So we kind of had, resources from, you know, as far away as Beaumont, all the way up into Houston. So,
wow.
Yeah, Ben was, you know, doing some of the same functionality. He was there specifically with his team. My role was sort of more on the next level up, the kind of command and control structure. So I was actually working with multiple different teams. We were sort of engaged in multiple different places all at the same time. I think overall the federal resources were at best we could count, and we did not count many just because we didn't have the ability to capture the data. But well over 6,000 rescues. And again, I think the number is probably double that. I just think that's the difficulty of trying to keep up with numbers and all that sort of stuff in a very difficult environment and with communications being very challenging.
Jamie, do you have any questions for Joe?
Despite the challenges that you guys had, one of the things that I saw continuously related on the news was the just sheer numbers of rescues that happened regardless of the challenges that the teams that were coming in faced and the local teams faced. They still managed to get their jobs done. Was this just a factor of just the resiliency of the teams, or was it preparedness training in advance, or a combination of the two?
Well, I think you said it very nicely. I think it is a combination of the two. You know, we certainly found the folks of Texas to be very hardy, very resilient, very kind, very thankful. And, everybody seemed to really come together quite nicely to support each other. We would go into some neighborhoods that were extremely nice neighborhoods that were flooded out, and the entire street might be underwater, but at the end of the street where it's dry is the whole neighborhood standing around, and everybody's got their boat out or their jet ski or their canoe, and they're headed down in the neighborhood looking for everything from their neighbors to the local cat and everything else that might need to come out of there. So a huge amount of sort of neighbor helping neighbor in a lot of cases, and I think a very well organized and managed emergency response system in Houston and the surrounding area. Many kudos to Texas on really having very high quality folks and a very robust system that they were able to, manage that incredible disaster really pretty well, considering how difficult that one was.
Yeah, I would have to agree. Kyle, any questions from you?
No, I'm just kind of taking it all in. It's been a pretty incredible response so far. It sounds like, with teams being, in the Houston and Texas areas and now being called away to other parts of the country, I guess perhaps Joe could kind of talk to this, but, with the infrastructure and the systems that we have in place, at least at the federal level, now you combine that with all the wildfires in the Northwest, what are we looking at as far as capabilities? Are those capabilities diminished, or are we going to be able to hold our own here, Joe?
Well, I think that's a great question, Kyle. For the Harvey response, we had some portion of every team in the system active. For probably 40% of the teams, we had just activated their water-capable water rescue resources. So the rest of the team is, still intact and still at home. But clearly a huge strain on or huge test of the system anyway, with the idea that literally within 24 hours of being deactivated from that response and sort of shifting all of the final, rescue, search, cleanup, et cetera, efforts back to the state of Texas, those teams are turned around and already moving or will be moving in the morning toward staging for Irma. So for some portion of those teams, they have not even made it home yet. I know we turned several teams around about halfway home and essentially instructed the teams to start moving into the staging positions and to take their team members and offload them and fly them home and fly a new team in to pick up the equipment and be ready to go again. So I think it says a lot about the people that are involved in the system. It says a lot about the capability and the competency of these teams. it says a lot about sort of the depth of the ability by a relatively small number of people. If you look at, you know, the number of folks that are in the federal urban search and rescue system, to be able to, you know, literally with 20 hours at home, turn it all around and go out the door again for another unknown amount of time, however long it's going to take to deal with this thing in Florida, at least initially. And as you described earlier, this thing goes all the way up the coast. Then, man, we're going to have another Matthew on our hands by some accounts, just sort of chasing this thing all the way up the East Coast.
That's a fact. And, you know, the point you're making, Joe, is something I can seriously relate to, is the dynamic. I mean, almost minute by minute, something changes. And you found that out just, you know, trying to get from one place to the other. And we found the same thing. We came into Dallas-Fort Worth. We had a team of six. There were three teams that do what we do, and they were scattered around. And so we started in Dallas-Fort Worth, went to the federal warehouse and checked our equipment and so forth. And it was an interesting bunch of people. It was almost all retired cops and firefighters, or existing cops and firefighters. So there was an immediate synergy between the bunch of us. And so we did that, and then they decided to send us to Houston, and we were originally going to go by helicopter, and then that changed, and we ended up driving down. So we were in Houston the rest of the time. But the other thing you said is very true, too. The Texas people were very efficient. So by virtue of that, we didn't get as many patients as we expected to have, or certainly wasn't a worst-case scenario. But our team being new, we had the opportunity to integrate with a lot of people. And all of this is about integrating resources, especially doing what we were doing. We had the Texas Guard right in the tent with us. We did a number of exercises. We did a lot of training, which was good because some of these people had not interacted with what our team does as far as assessment and figuring out where people are going to fly to and setting that up and all of that. So we had the Texas Guard in there with her. We were working directly with the Air Force, directly with DOD, I mean, a lot of the other federal agencies. So that was kind of neat in the fact that we got the chance to do that, to integrate with those agencies almost on a training level. So if we end up doing it again in Irma, even though those were the Texas folks, we as a team have a lot better idea of how that works. And I just think it ended up being a very positive thing, even though we didn't treat patients as much as we thought. We certainly felt like we accomplished something. But just like you were saying, everything changed. We were demobilized one morning, and then the next day they decided we'd go back to staging, which means we're still active, but they don't know where they're going to put us yet. And I think at that point they decided the best thing was to move resources out of Houston, especially since we had so many of the Florida teams in that area, get them home, because they have their regular jobs they're going to need to be dealing with if this hits Florida, which it sure looks like it will. And also for the rest of us to get a bit of a break before we have to, because they know these resources are going to have to go in and deal with Irma once we know what she's going to do. So this is a unique situation, as you were explaining, Joe, because I don't think they've ever had a situation where they got one storm piling up behind another one, and they're having to shift. I got to give the feds credit. I would not want to be the guy having to figure this out. You know, what resources do you have out there? Which ones do you need to demobilize? Which ones do you need to bring back in? You're bringing them into different teams because of the teams that have since deployed. I mean, it's just a nightmare. I can't even imagine being a travel person for the federal government. It's got to be the most complex job in the world right now. So I got to give them credit. This is just unprecedented. So it's just really going to be interesting. But a question I have for you, Joe, looking at where Irma has been, and Jamie sent us some information today that was just kind of mind-boggling from CNN about one of the islands actually losing about 90% of their functionality. And they really thought they had some pretty sturdy buildings there. From a USAR perspective, what kind of buildings can hold up to a Cat 5? And what would we tend to see on these small islands?
Well, that's a really good question, Sam. You know, I think from our standpoint, we carry a structural engineer with us for exactly that reason, to help us assess the amount of damage to those buildings and the likelihood that if they have collapsed, that there are void spaces in there for survivors, and to help us as we attempt to shore those buildings up so that we can get access to them. I think part of the challenge with a hurricane is not only do you have sort of unprecedented 175 mile an hour winds, but tremendous storm surge, huge amounts of rain, flooding. You've got sort of all the forces of nature at work, as opposed to something like an earthquake, which might shake the building down, but wouldn't necessarily have things like erosion of the foundation and all that kind of stuff that would occur from tremendous amounts of water running past it or through it or under it, storm surge, all that sort of stuff. So there are so many different factors at work here that I think it's got to prove a real challenge for engineers and architects to design and construct a building that can manage that many different kinds of forces all at the same time.
This is kind of a general question, but what do you think the recovery effort is going to be like? It's just unfathomable to me.
Well, I would agree with you. I think it's going to be a monster recovery effort. You know, I was thinking as I was listening to you a second ago, quite honestly, had we not been in Texas dealing with a state that has applied an adequate amount of financial and human capital toward their ability to respond to and deal with disasters, we would not have been in a situation, and by we, I mean the federal search and rescue system, would not have been in a situation where we could have got done what we needed to do for them and been able to transition it back to state resources for them to handle and get out of there so that we can have a albeit brief opportunity to retool and repair and, you know, fix equipment, et cetera, and be ready for the next one. There are certainly some states that have not done as good a job and do not commit as many resources as somewhere like Texas does. And I could certainly see that in those states, we would much more likely be still there, still working, and, you know, still carrying a pretty good amount of that load, trying to get things taken care of.
No, I totally agree. Kudos to Texas. And I expect that Florida, as much as they've been hit, is much the same. But I think about, the U.S., Virgin Islands and Puerto Rico and some of the other things, they may not fare as well. So I think the recovery may be quite different for them. Kyle, your thoughts on that? And also, I have a question for you. I'm looking at the CNN map that Jamie sent us earlier. What is a spaghetti model? I'm sorry, I have to ask that.
Well, Sam, I'll jump right to your question there on the spaghetti models, because that's something that a lot of folks have been posting online. They're posting, sometimes it's just one model track on where the center of the hurricane is forecast to go. And when you see these, what they call spaghetti plots, these are, it's kind of a funny term that's used, but essentially it's a collection of models that are each run with either some different physics and how they're programmed and how they handle the weather. Or it could be the same model, and we just kind of tweak the data that's put into it just a little bit to build in uncertainty into those models. And when you run them out, when they start, they're often very close together, and then they kind of spread out and look like if you took a handful of spaghetti and threw it up, say, on the wall or on a sheet of paper or on a desk. And to the untrained eye, these can lead people to believe one thing or another, and leave those in the interpretation of those to the experts, and focus on the cone of the track and the cone of uncertainty that the National Hurricane Center puts out. That's based on science. That's interpreted and then communicated by those experts.
Ah, good point. What is your, and I know you have been very good on social media about getting good, honest information out there. And I know there's been some misinformation out there. And you don't like to project that which you can't project. But what is just a gross estimation of what does the rest of the hurricane season look like? I mean, how much potential is there for more of this between now and when it's over?
Well, Sam, as I mentioned earlier on, we are right at the peak of the Atlantic hurricane season. We are approaching it, and right now, if the current trend continues and we keep having these disturbances, form in the Atlantic and spin up, the environment's really, it's really favorable for hurricane development right now. And this is the trend that right now we're going to expect to see continue. The National Hurricane Center very early on was predicting a near to above normal hurricane season for the Atlantic. And right now that prediction is definitely verifying. And again, I can't say anything with any high degree of confidence looking farther out for the rest of the season. I haven't looked that far ahead yet. We're more focused on the here and now, but I think this just is a good reminder for everyone that no matter what the forecast is, even a below, normal hurricane season, well, yeah, that's the entire Atlantic basin, but it only takes one hurricane, one tropical storm, one event to make your hurricane season the worst ever.
Boy, that's the truth. Joe, I saw one headline I was found kind of interesting, and we haven't talked in terms of utilities being down, that kind of thing, but I can't remember where I saw it exactly, but it was like social media is taking the place of the other means of communication that are no longer available. Were you seeing some of that in Texas?
Yeah, it was a really unique situation there, actually from several different levels. One of the things I think for my team and others that was a bit different is that the cell phone network remained pretty functional and fairly robust, although obviously everybody was on it. And it was being stressed by lots of people sending, pictures and everything else. I was quite amazed in we had several instances where we were performing a rescue of people that were on, say, the third floor of an apartment complex where water was all the way up into the second floor, and the people on the third floor still had power. And that was a little bit surprising, quite concerning in many ways, because we just never knew when something was going to happen with that building and the power was going to short out, et cetera. And then, as you just said, the social media aspect turned out to be really very interesting. We literally had. I'm confident that my team fielded probably 15 or 20 messages that were, for example, posted on social media, Facebook, Twitter, whatever, and somebody would see it and realize that, Joe's in that area. I'm going to tag him on this post so he can see it. And then I would get visibility on that. And, for a lot of those cases, what we would do with those is capture whatever minimum information there was to capture and forward that to, for example, Houston Emergency Services through their Emergency Operations Center, which was an amazing place to see. We can spend a whole episode talking about that sometime, but they were able to pass that over to the EMS desk, and the EMS was able to make a response out there and check on what needed to be done. So it was certainly a case where social media generated a lot of calls for help, a lot of situational awareness issues. We used technology, I think, a little bit differently on this deployment amongst teams than we had in the past. You know, we're used to and comfortable with utilizing radio communications and setting up our own communication systems, because we always end up in places where, you know, there's no power, there's no cell phone, there's no nothing, sort of the ultimate in austere conditions. But this one, again, was a bit unique in that, you know, cell phones were working and that system did pretty well. So we were able to do things like utilizing some chat apps on our telephone, be able to put together a chat that included the medical team docs from all the task forces in the theater, and share information amongst ourselves very quickly and easily. If one of us saw something that was of note that the others might could benefit from, we could post that. And, you know, so we could do that for lots of different disciplines, from safety to medicine to you know, general messages out to the team and all kinds of stuff. And that was a bit of a unique experience as well. I think those things have tremendous usefulness, provided they work. And I guess that's the downside, is if you don't have connectivity, they're not going to work. So, you know, we'll have to continue to see whether or not we're going to be able to utilize stuff like that, probably or obviously only in an environment where you know, the teams have connectivity to make that work. Otherwise, we got to revert to, you know, old technology like radios and satellite phones and stuff like that.
Wow, fascinating. Jamie, you know, you were the one at home, and I know how much you watch social media. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's interesting because I was watching Governor Scott of Florida on his press conference this afternoon, a few hours before we recorded this, and something very interesting was said. He talked about how he was coordinating with the cell carriers, including and as well as some of the cable companies, to implement free hotspots around the state, hundreds of them, to facilitate free access for people to get on to the internet and coordinate with their families, coordinate their evacuation, contact authorities. And I have to think, because I didn't see any mention of this coming into Harvey, that maybe this was a reaction to the fact that social media played such a big role in what happened and the response to getting people rescued in the response to Harvey, because I didn't see anything like that come up from the preparations for the Texas event. But I was surprised to see that very thing talked about. And of course, you know, this is the kind of thing that Joe's just mentioned. If we can maintain more connectivity, then people can have more options to coordinate and communicate. I'm sure Kyle probably has a comment too.
Kyle?
Yeah, Jamie. That's whether or not it was a reaction to what we saw with Hurricane Harvey, there is absolutely no question that social media has absolutely changed the way that we experience, respond to, and will recover from disasters now and in the future. With Governor Scott down in Florida doing that, I believe it's a brilliant idea. Giving folks the connectivity online allows them to stay in touch with their neighbors and their family. And if we can build that, the self-resiliency and reliance, even if it's through online communications or building this online community, that self-reliance ultimately leads to less strain on local, state, and ultimately federal resources, depending on how bad the impacts truly are. And with allowing people to communicate together, to share their stories and to talk online, that also assists with recovery as well and allows folks to get back to that sense of normalcy. Because just going back to what Joe said, you know, he goes, Joe said earlier, we are comfortable with communicating on radios. Well, it goes back to what you're comfortable with. You know, am I going to, you know, go on and use some, you know, a system that I'm not familiar with? Or am I going to jump online and, you know, perhaps create a Facebook group or a Facebook page that's focused on recovery or resiliency in my community and build my community and bring it together online?
Joe, back to you.
Well, I think Kyle's got a great point there. You know, it certainly was a, I won't say a new element for us. We've toyed with it some before, but obviously in many situations we've been in, the ability to use social media is limited because we're not connected, because the whole system is down. This one was certainly unique in that regard, and I hope part of what that says is that the wireless infrastructure in this country continues to improve and become more robust and more resilient. And I hope that's the case, because the impact of that is huge in many ways. And again, as Kyle pointed out, you know, the ability to get particular information about what somebody needs, I think many of those social media interactions that we had were really just someone saying, we're in our home, we can't get out. We need some food. We need our medicines refilled. That kind of stuff. That certainly allows the response system to triage them and send the appropriate resource for them, as opposed to dedicating a rescue boat at 4 o'clock in the morning to instead. A less intense resource the next morning that can bring them what they need. In reality, they're fine. They're just stuck in their building and they can't get out. And if we can just get them a few things to allow them to continue to shelter in place, then great. That's that much less load on the system. So, I think there's no question that just between literally in the 24 hours between Harvey and Irma, we have already seen a significant increase in our team's use of and access to and evolution of social media embeds for us to try to be even more responsive and take greater advantage of them. Not knowing whether or not we're going to have connectivity wherever we end up going to work in Florida or wherever we end up. But, you know, the idea that even in the pre-impact time frame, we're able to share information and avoid redundant attempts to collect information for teams that are in transition, currently moving, et cetera, where their connectivity may be hit and miss, but that those teams are, landing at a staging area with a fair amount of information already in hand and prepared for areas that they're going to go into ahead of time without us sort of individually all having to collect that information. We can do it much more as a group. We can add to each other's bits of knowledge as to, where the hospitals around the Miami area, what's their capability. We're always, part of our job is to collect that kind of intel for where would our people go if they got hurt, where would civilians go, what are the capabilities of those hospitals, and then, of course, to continuously reassess whether during the course of the event, is that center, that hospital still capable at that level? Have they had diminished capabilities from some reason? Do we need to change our medical plan? Do we need to change our evacuation plan, et cetera? So there, the ability of the teams to ramp that up much more quickly and be much more aware of that, I think is going to provide huge benefit down the road for the efficiency of the teams and the responsiveness of the teams.
Oh, totally agree. What was I looking at? I think before we leave this, though, we talk a lot about preparedness, and I don't think it's could be more important than it is right now, because there's a lot of people in this path. Jamie, what are some thoughts? I think we can just kind of recap some of the things we've talked about in the past. What are some of the things that come to mind for you looking at the East Coast?
Well, you know, there's a possibility that that I can, you know, that I'll see some effect from this storm if it comes up the coast and gets to Maryland with any kind of, you know, strength left. It could, you know, we could see at least some significant rainfall and possible flash flooding from this. So, you know, when you look at a storm that's 350 miles across, you're talking about widespread, at least moderate impacts from this storm on a broad swath across the whole East Coast. And maybe Kyle can talk to that a little bit. But I think everybody needs to, you know, understand and keep in touch, as Kyle has said before, with their local authorities on what preparations make the most sense for their community. You know, there are places where they're going to be evacuated, like the Florida Keys. People are being pulled out because there's one road in and one road out. And if anything disables that road, people are stranded. In other places, it's going to be more of a shelter in place or general preparedness rules as you move farther up the coast. So I think that, you know, the most important thing is to be aware of the risks for your community by being in touch with the official resources and authorities in your area. Kyle, thoughts on that?
Yeah, Jamie, just thanks for echoing some of my comments there from earlier on focusing on the folks in your local area who are keyed in on any projected impacts that you may or will likely experience. I'd also like to just kind of throw out some awareness and preparedness things, and kind of with the headline, you know, don't be scared, be prepared, because, you know, hurricanes are survivable if proper precautions and actions are taken. And the biggest one is to, you know, heed those warnings and alerts from local authorities. If you're asked to evacuate, do it. If you're physically unable to do so, authorities will likely have plans in place in order to assist you out. I also want you to avoid the misconception of, well, but I'm not where the center of the track, or I'm not where the eye is going to go. Folks, Irma is a giant storm, as Jamie hinted at. Tropical storm force winds currently 185 miles in all directions around the center of this storm. Rain bands extend farther out than that. Direct impacts on nearly the entire state of Florida are probable, especially in the peninsula, but the highest risk is definitely shifting toward the Keys, all the way up the Atlantic coast. And of course, as Jamie hinted at, Georgia, North Carolina, South Carolina, you folks are not out of the woods yet. It's depending on the track that Irma takes, reemergence with reintensification and maybe even a second landfall, hopefully maybe just a side swipe at that point, are all possible. We're still 4 to 5 days out, knowing that for sure. And that cone from the National Hurricane Center is so wide, that far out, because that's the average error over time. So that it's that wide for a reason. The center of the storm can be anywhere within that cone as it goes further and further out in time. So, again, looking more and more likely, like, you know, Florida is going to be impacted more directly. But that doesn't mean, if you're not exactly where the eye is or where the center of that storm is going to track, that you are out of the woods. So stay informed, stay safe, and we're going to do our best to keep you up to date.
Thank you, Kyle. That's excellent. Joe, on the issue of, you know, hunkering down and staying, or, you know, people don't realize when they're going to end up needing to be rescued, but looking at making those choices, what are the dangers in terms of rescues and having to be in that situation for people?
Well, it's some of the same stuff we've talked about before. I can tell you at Harvey, we had several very close calls with professional rescuers who are very experienced and very well equipped and very well trained. And I'll tell you about those in just a couple of minutes. But, you know, we saw a huge number of people who, you know, brought out their boats to, you know, get in the water and go looking for folks. And while I think that's noble and laudable in a lot of ways, I think there folks need to do that with a real focus on safety. We saw many of those boats get turned over because, you know, while it looks like floodwaters are still waters in many cases, the fact that that water is actually moving and moving quite quickly through those areas, you just don't notice it when it's over a very broad area until you suddenly get to an intersection of a street where, you know, the cross current is pretty significant, or between houses, or, you know, it's just areas where water's never flowed before. So unless you're pretty savvy at your ability to handle that kind of stuff, and unless you've got the right equipment with you to protect yourself and supposedly the people that you're going to rescue, I would really discourage folks from doing that. We had a couple episodes where we, because the water was moving much more than was apparent from the surface, when the water's 30 feet deep, it's hard to appreciate what's going on at the bottom. So we had a couple of rescuers who did everything right as far as safety and precautions, right down to safety lines and personal flotation devices and, you know, dry suits and the whole bit. I mean, these guys were very, very well prepared to be in that environment, and crossed over a bridge on a road and noticed a vehicle off in the ditch submerged to the roof line, and went down to check on the vehicle to ensure that nobody was in there, and were literally sucked into a drain pipe about 24 inches around, and two of them, one trying to help the other guy after he got caught up in it and was slowly being pulled under until he, you know, popped his line and allowed himself to go down through the drain. Thank goodness the drain was about 100 feet long and dumped off into the creek that they had just driven over. And so both these guys shot through this pipe and came up somewhere downstream, and about a half a mile downstream were able to finally, you know, come to their senses and be able to get themselves out of the water. But an incredibly close call that easily could have resulted in two rescuers' deaths. And these are guys that know their stuff and know what they're doing. So, you know, I think as we always say, that idea of self-deployment and, getting out there and trying to do the right thing, it's great when it works, but boy, the possibilities of it becoming tragic are quite easy. There was at least one report of electrocution death of a guy who was going to his sister's apartment or something to get her cat out, and was electrocuted and killed. There were multiple episodes where civilian boats were overturned and overloaded and everything else. I literally saw people putting their 23-foot ski boat into the water in their neighborhood with the idea that they were going to drive around in their neighborhood and do rescues. And, you know, just the idea of having no idea whether or not there's a car underneath there or a sign or electrical box or whatever that boat may well run into is a little bit frightening. And I don't know that we didn't have an awful lot of incidences related to that. I didn't see many of those, thank goodness, but obviously I wasn't everywhere all the time. So I have to assume that a lot of people got significant damage to their boats and hopefully didn't hurt themselves in the process. But I just think that's always something to be wary of, that those are very, very dangerous situations to put yourself in, and you better be well prepared for whatever you might face there.
Oh, my God, George. I'm so glad you brought that up, because people don't think about things like that. And as well-intended as they may be, they end up being another victim, and you guys need to go out and rescue them. I can't imagine going through that pipe. Oh, my God. Jamie made the comment, that's horrifying, and I have to agree with that.
Well, we actually were really glad that those guys were okay. We immediately did, a bit of an investigation into that so that we could understand what happened. We shared that with all of our other teams, literally within 24 hours, had a bit of a safety refresh and just said, guys, you're two guys that are professionals and know what they're doing, and it happened to them, please be careful out there. We had a truck turnover. We had one boat that was destroyed, because the water moved so quickly, it pushed the boat up against a bridge and just, destroyed it. The toll on equipment and people in those situations is pretty substantial. We were certainly very hard on a lot of our equipment. We had trucks that were submerged to halfway down the doors. And so, you have to worry about the transmission and the differential and the axles and everything else. And, the need to get those checked out and make sure that they're not full of water. And I know we destroyed at least a couple of vehicles by water ingestion. I think it's, you don't see that kind of stuff on TV very much. And I think it's important that people appreciate that's a very, very difficult environment. It's a very dangerous environment. And while the waters may look fairly calm and just like a bunch of muddy water, it's basically sewage and petroleum products. And it's moving much faster than you think it is. And there's all kinds of stuff buried underneath it that can hurt you real bad. And so I would just encourage folks to be extremely careful and cognizant that environment is a very dangerous place to be.
Well, you just touched on the next question I was going to ask as we wind down here. The water itself. I mean, I remember in Katrina, people that were in the water ended up with burns on them when they came out. And you're talking about petroleum and other things being in the water. So that's a danger in and of itself. Did you want to comment on that?
Yeah, I'll be glad to. I think it won't be much different in the Houston area. It is an area that is replete with lots of petroleum industry installations. There was a big explosion at a chemical plant that put out a plume of toxic stuff that affected several law enforcement guys that were attempting to keep that area cordoned off. We saw certainly a fair amount of big sites that were underwater. I'm pretty sure there are more than 10 Superfund sites by the EPA that are in that area, most of which were inundated by water. And therefore concerns over that stuff leaching into the current water, much less the drinking water and everything else as time goes by. So, the potential for a pretty substantial environmental catastrophe there, I think will be ongoing for a long time.
Oh, my God, Joe, I'm glad you brought all of this up. There are things that we just haven't thought about or you don't see on the news. Would you agree, Jamie?
I would, and it brings me back around to what we always talk about as we kind of wrap down the show each week, is that, as Joe pointed out, training is so vital and so important to, what helps these responders survive, even in the best situations. That training can be tested, even to the best, most prepared person. And I'm just curious, Joe, this is something, one of the things when we talk about experiential training and the way that you guys at Paragon Medical Education Group bring this type of disaster preparedness training to organizations and jurisdictions, it's because of this type of experience that you and your other people have responding to actual disasters, where we get into these types of unique situations where somebody gets sucked into a drain pipe.
Well, you're exactly right, Jamie. Interestingly enough, probably 70% of my group was active in the Hurricane Harvey response, and I feel confident that a majority of us will also be active in the Irma response. And, you know, our goal is to take what we learn in those situations and from many situations in the past and bring those to the folks that that are there to learn.
If somebody's listening to this, and we you know, are regular listeners, we have new listeners all the time, especially given the current disaster situations, where can they find you guys online if they want to find out what kind of training you do, how they can bring you into their system? Because I think this is a question that after this response and the pending response with Irma, a lot of areas are going to be wanting to ramp up their planning and training.
Oh, I think there's no question about that. You can find us at ParagonMedicalGroup.com or through Facebook. We're on Facebook at Paragon Medical Group. You can also reach us through the Disaster Podcast at any time. And I would certainly encourage folks to take advantage of a phenomenally experienced group of people who can help you work through all the different nuances that are associated with this. We'll actually be in Bogota, Colombia in just about 3 weeks doing training with them related to, and we'll be incorporating a lot of the stuff that's coming out of the Harvey and Irma response right now.
Well, and I know people are going to appreciate that, and I'm sure the people down in Colombia will as well. Thanks for that, Joe. Kyle, where can folks find you?
Well, Jamie, folks can find me on all social medias under the handle WX Kyle Nelson. So feel free to connect with me online and continue the conversation.
And I would just second that. Kyle has been a wealth of information and posting a lot of good, high-quality resources online just in the last few days alone. And I think that everyone would be well-served from getting their weather information and updates on where to look for their area from Kyle by following his social media feeds. And thanks for doing that, Kyle.
Absolutely.
Sam, where can folks find you?
Well, that's a good question, Jamie. In the next few days, that could be just about anywhere, somewhere around the East Coast or following an Irma's path. But I am always on social media to the extent I can access it and have the time to do that. Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, Facebook, Twitter, and so forth. This is a good opportunity to, you know, stay in touch with our Facebook site. If you haven't signed up, it's easy to do. I think there'll be a lot of information about what we're doing and so forth going up on there and what the storm's doing, and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com website. So please give us your thoughts and your questions, and we'll do our best to answer those for you.
And we'll be making this. Usually we take longer episodes like this and split them in two, but because of the timely nature of this, we're going to get this put out before Irma lands, wherever it lands, on the in Florida or along the East Coast or wherever it hits. We're going to have this episode out there so that people can learn some lessons from what happened at Harvey and be better prepared for what's going to be coming up with Irma. And so we'll have like a really long episode rather than our usual half hour or so episodes. But I think that's important to do. As far as me, you can find me under the handle PodMedic in most social media locations out there. So friend or follow me there. And always check us out over on our Disaster Podcast Facebook group. Just search Disaster Podcast. Ask to join the group. We'll be glad to let you in. And there's some great discussions. We post our episode links there as well and other information as it comes up throughout the course of special events like what's going on right now. Sam, you know, I think you learned lessons. Joe learned lessons. Heck, just sitting at home, I think Kyle and I learned a lot just from watching and talking about what happened with Harvey. And I think we're going to probably learn a lot more lessons with Irma as well.
Oh, no question, Jamie, because this is certainly unprecedented, not only the size of Irma, but the fact that we have these two storms back to back. So the after action reports on these are going to be amazing. It'll probably take a long time to compile all that information. But in any case, I think Joe and I have certainly discovered that what we always say is disaster medicine, or austere medicine, is not our everyday medicine.